You are listening to Blackburn Nine's Breakfast Club. I'm your host, Frederick C. Blackburn. And tonight's episode is episode 194 and is entitled Dial V for Cheka Vendetta. Dial V for Cheka Vendetta. And we're going to be looking at the history of Star Chambers justice and vigilante justice, and also just the letter V itself. That is a very interesting letter V. And if you'd like to join us, you can come out to the chat room at bb9.chitango.com. That's bb9.chitango.com. And so when we look at this idea of Star Chamber justice and the idea of vendetta, Webster's defines a vendetta as a private feud, any prolonged and bitter feud, rivalry, or conflict. And nothing to me, you know, that word vendetta just really sums up the utter contempt and hatred that the Jewish people have for the rest of the world, especially white people. That is known as Locksism. It is just this pure hate. And, you know, naive me growing up with my Anne Frank goggles with all my Jewish friends, you know, you never realize just how deep-seated this emotional state is amongst the Jewish people and how it has become such a integral part of their identity politics. And it's this bubble of we are the eternal innocent victims that have been persecuted for centuries, for thousands of years, for just trying to exist and to practice our religion. This is how they always say it. It's like, you know, we have just been persecuted forever for just being who we are. And now it's our turn to get vengeance. That's the key thing about this modern Maccabee movement of world Zionism. It's all about a justified vengeance on all the white people of the world for the sins of the fathers. Even though supposedly at Nuremberg, that great pinnacle of justice, collective punishments were supposedly outlawed at Nuremberg, where that was one of the big takeaways with Nuremberg. No more collective punishments, but I guess the small print was no more collective punishments against Jewish people, but collective punishment against Palestinians and white Europeans is perfectly fine because of what they did to us. And the Holocaust TM trademark, echo, 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 the Holo hoax, is so key to holding that system together that anything we do, no matter how horrible, how illegal, unconstitutional, crimes against humanity it may be, is completely justified because of the Holocaust, because we're going to make sure that that never happens again. In other words, we're never going to let any power group exist on this planet ever to rise up and have enough power to do collective punishment against the Jewish people ever again. And you think about that, that ever since World War II, it has just been one maneuver after another to tear down existing power systems, the Catholic Church, the Protestant churches that used to know who Jews were, governments like the United States, Germany, Russia, France, England, that they will never rise to a power level so that they can do collective punishment against the Jewish people. Never again. And that basically means never again will anyone have power over us. We are going to be the masters of these this planet, and everyone else is now going to be our slaves. And when you look at the history, no one ever tried, well, I don't want to say no one, but the idea of enslaving the Jews doesn't make sense when you look at the history. Most of the time is basically the Europeans tried to get along with the Jews, live and let live. Yeah, they're just different. Their religion's different, but I guess they're good people. You know, they have families just like everybody else. And, you know, they're just trying to get along in this world until the reality of who the Jews are comes to play, that you've got this shadow cabal that works by infiltrating and enslaving people to it. It is a master-slave system that slowly sucks all the life and value out of the society until people have enough of it and they tell the Jews to leave. You know, how many times you see the Jews get thrown out of nations? And, of course, the Jews always play the innocent victim that, oh, you know, we didn't do anything wrong. Those anti-Semites persecuted us and threw us out and, you know, made us give back the stuff we stole from them legally. And, you know, when you start to see this, it's amazing just how these young Jewish kids are brainwashed into this vendetta mindset where every one of them is like, what can I do today for Israel and the Jewish people against our enemies? And the enemies are everyone who's not Jewish. Because until you are down on your knees accepting the Noahide laws, you know, you are their enemy. You know, you can be a good Noahide slave if you give up your faith, your nations, your laws, and just accept your role as a slave and agree to the 7 Noahide laws, and then the Jews will tolerate you until, you know, you're no longer useful to them. But, you know, that is what this reduces to. When we look at our 9-layer timeline, again, we go T9 is our way, way, way back yonder. This is the inorganic development of the solar system and the planet. At some point, you know, Earth came into being. T8, way, way back yonder, this is the organic development, you know, the beginnings of life. Then T7, way back yonder, 500,000 to 50,000 BC, this is when Homo sapiens appear in the archaeological record. T6 is the last great ice age, 50,000 to 22,000 BC. T5 is our gold era, 22,000 to 16,000 BC. This is the last great year. So Copernicus talked about the great year of 26,000 years, takes the zodiac to go around. So you think, yeah, that is the beginning of the last great year. We're now in the age of Aquarius moving forward. The last time we were in the age of Aquarius was in around 22,000 BC. And we call this our gold era, the, you know, when the sun came out and melted the ice in Europe. T4, the silver era, 16,000 to 10,000 BC. T3, copper era, 10,000 to 4,000 BC. T2, our iron era, 4,000 BC to 2000 AD. And then T1, our light era, 2000 AD to 8,000 AD. When we look at the letter V and all the words that you can think of that begin with the letter V, from vice to virtue, victim, valor, it's like this own little system of synthesis or thesis and antithesis into synthesis, like the Hegelian dialect, because, you know, no matter, it seems that there's a word that starts with a V and you can immediately think of another word that starts with the letter V. That's its exact opposite, like vice and virtue, victory and victim. The victor or the victim, and just amazing how many words and how old this phoneme is and how it is in so many languages. The sound of that letter V and also the symbol of the V is in so many systems and also have very similar words. And so you think, yeah, this is a very ancient word or of ancient letter. And in the English alphabet, it's, of course, the 22nd letter. So, you know, there's very highly symbolic, the 22 there. And then in the Hebrew alphabet, it's the 6th letter of vowel. Like people like Mr. Dennis Fecho, his very well-done esoteric work, you know, talks about these phonemes and the development of the language, and these, you know, letters are, have the numerical values they have not by chance or accident. This is a very strategic thing, and V is one of those that is very significant in so many esoteric systems. Now, when we look at, you know, the T7 way back yonder, one of the big parts of our development is the development of fire. And when you look at vengeance systems and the early forms of vengeance, you know, how often does fire show up in those stories, be it folk tales, fairy tales, religious texts, etc., you know, that the fire rained down. And so, you know, the idea of fire as so key to civilization. It's like, when did we learn how to control fire? And there's one thing of just having a fire and maintaining a fire, but there's a completely different thing of creating a fire. And can you imagine how magical that must have been to somebody who did not have that technology to be able to create fire from their fingertips, right? This is one of those old images of magic, is the person who can bring forth fire from their fingertips. And as part of my scout training, back when, before they turned Boy Scouts into the North American Man-Boy Love Association, and we used to do things like survival skills, one of the requirements was learning how to not only build a fire with matches, but, you know, can you build a fire with a bow drill, for example, using friction heat? Can you build a fire with flint and steel? The idea of sparking one thing against another. One of the best tricks is a piece of steel and a piece of flint has a good strike, but you can also do two rocks as a strike, a spark. And then to build a fire with solar, you're using a magnifying glass or a convex ice. You can actually mold in, you know, Arctic, you know, survival. You know, if you're doing winter camping, you can actually make a lens out of ice to be able to focus a light, the sunbeam, onto a dot like a magnifying glass. You can make a fire using batteries and steel wool. You know, there's, you can use, you know, several things to make a fire, but that was very, very advanced technology there, that you could control fire, you could make fire from your fingertips. And the old record said that our control of fires, what happened during our T7 way back yonder, 500,000 to 50,000 BC, at around 250,000 BC. But other research has shown that other variants, like Cro-Magnon, actually had fire technologies based on hearths found in Palestine with burnt wood and flint that pushed the date back to 790 BC, well before Homo sapiens. But as far as Homo sapiens goes, you know, the accepted date used to be around 250,000 BC. And so with that, you know, you think about as we developed, you know, how much of a force multiplier having fire technology was, especially going into the last great ice age at T6, 50,000 to 22,000 BC. And this, of course, was, you know, problematic in that time is, you know, what are you going to burn? What kind of fuel do you have in an ice age? And so that kind of like, you know, I wonder if there was a rediscovery after the ice age of relearning fire technology that may have been lost. That's the other thing about, you know, technologies is, you know, in a disaster, so much of your advanced civilization is going to be lost as people focus on just surviving. And so fire technology is definitely one of those civilization-changing things. And then, you know, we move into our calendar technology at 30,000 BC. This is when we come up with the 28-day lunar calendar. And then in our T5 gold era, 20,000 BC, is when we have our 13-month lunar calendar. And one of the things that's interesting there is in Genesis, you talk about, you know, the day and the night. And as the cloud, you know, the weather's clearing up and you're moving out of the ice age where everything's just gray and darkness, to actually having day and night cycles. And this is why our gold era, we symbolize it with our X. And then we talk about how that upper part of the X is the V, the cup symbol for water. And this symbolizes the night and the moon. And then the phallus shape is the wand. The bottom half of the X is the wand, the fire symbol, the day symbol, the sun. And so immediately start associating fire with the sun symbolism in all of these philosophies, esoteric religions, etc. And the moon as a fluid thing because it fills like a cup. It can be a quarter full, it can be a half full, three quarters full, all the way full, or it can be completely empty, like a new moon up through a full moon. And when we look at the how this is preserved in simple board games like checkers, for example, in checkers, you have a 64-square black and red checkerboard and then the 12 black discs and the 12 red discs. And this is the 12 hours of the day and the 12 hours of the night. So, you know, in this early technologies, like quickly, you know, coming up with an hour system as in addition to a day system and then moving into a week system of 7 days a week, into a 4 week month system, into a 13 month calendar system. And these early systems are preserved in those early games like checkers. And one of the interesting things about a lot of these early societies is you would actually have a queen and then you would have a king of the day and a king of the night or of the shadows. And so this is the early development of the king, the sun king, the visible king, but also the hidden king, the secret king, the person who is king that nobody knows who they are except for the initiates in the inner circles. And so this idea of the two kings battling, the 12 hours of the day king and the 12 hours of the night king are preserved in those early games like checkers. And then as you move into the silver era, at 12,000 BC, well, the silver era, 16,000 to 10,000 BC, and this is our triangle. And here you start to see evidence of controlled burns of grasslands and pre-farming as you're moving out of that hunter-gatherer and cave-dweller type system of the Ice Age into hunting ground seasonal migrations, and that people were actually using controlled burns to make grasslands for the animals so that they would basically have a ready supply of food in those areas. And it's interesting that in Freemasonry, one of the big symbols is the 24-inch rule that they fold into a triangle, an equilateral triangle, and each side having 8 hours. And the Mason is told that, you know, these are how a Freemason divides his time, is in these three 8-hour blocks. You know, you sleep and sleep and take food for 8 hours, and then you have your duty to God for 8 hours, and then all your duties to your personal life for 8 hours. And so that's interesting symbolism there, breaking that 24 down into the 8-hour cycles, and that there's a certain mystery of those hours from midnight to sun up, you know, from midnight to 8 a.m., because that's when all the hidden hand, the hidden king, and all the hobgoblins come out at night. In so many of the fairy tales and legends and religions, and also that's a huge part of the development of Star Chamber Justice, is that, you know, you're snatched in the night while everyone's asleep, you know, where everybody wakes up in the morning for their normal chores and you're just not there. You've been taken, and everybody knows that they're not supposed to go looking for you because the hidden hand has taken you. God has taken you. You know, you have been found guilty by something and you have just been disappeared in the night. Then you move into T3 Copper Era, and this is when you start to see the city-states like Jericho being developed around 6500 BC. This, you know, our symbol for the copper era is a circle, and this is also when we start using metals for ornamental purposes. Also domestication of sheep, goats, cattle, pigs, dogs, and honeybees, and farming, domestication of, you know, lentils and oats and wheats and all of that. And this is where you start to get the inner circles of this societal model that is summed up in what we call the abracadabra and the Babylon model, the seven-layer models that, you know, the Jews talk about their New World Order all the time, but it's actually a very ancient system. It's the same seven-layer system. They've just basically swapped out the queen for the Jewish people. But, you know, when you look at how this system was preserved in the games like of chess, you have a 64 square, an 8x8 square chessboard, black and white. Again, you know, day and night, good and bad, light and darkness. And then you have opposing armies. And the most powerful chess piece is the queen. And you put the queen in a corner of the chessboard, and you see that she can move in three directions for seven squares. Because, you know, she's sitting on one, she can go diagonally seven squares, she can go up and down seven squares, or left to right over seven squares. So there's that 777 that makes up that esoteric triangle of the calendar system. And, you know, that the hidden hand is that 777 pyramid at the top of the pyramid. And then you have the king that can move in any direction one square, right? then the knight, then the bishop, the rook, and the pawn, and then the missing piece, the piece that has been taken off the board, the piece that has been captured, the piece that has been removed. And that's the thing about the that zeta level, when we break it down and say, okay, the queen's at the 777 layer, the king's at the alpha layer, the knight's at the beta layer, the bishop's at the gamma layer, the rook's at the delta layer, the pawn's at the epsilon layer, the killed piece, the captured piece, the piece that has been removed is at that zeta layer at one. And then in playing cards, you see these same symbols with, you know, we're always taught that the king is the main card in popular poker cards. But, you know, when you look at the system of around the T3 era, the queen, these are matriarchal systems, the queen was top, and then she would choose the king, you know, the best of the best, the alpha king, and then the jacks. Then you would have diamonds, hearts, clubs, and spades. So queen at seven, kings at six, jacks at five, diamonds at four, hearts at three, clubs at two, spades at one. Or if you want to use tarot imagery, you have the queen, king, jack, and then discs, cups, wands, and swords. And again, you know, you have the black set and the white set. King of the day, king of the night, queen of the day, queen of the night type system, and the idea of the enemy, the adversary, the other. And, you know, so it's just fascinating how much of this system is preserved in the games. Like I said, if you really want to understand the, quote, New World Order, echo, 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 understand, you know, what's really going on with checkers and a checkerboard, chess and a chessboard, playing cards, tarot cards, and dice. Single dice and a pair of dice give you all the numerology symbolism that is in the Kabbalah and the Talmud and the Zohar and the, you know, all these other Jewish systems, but it basically breaks down to this seven-layer system. And then as we move into the Iron Era, this is when the matriarchy gives way to the patriarchy systems, and you think the virtues of one age become the vices of the next age. And so when one of the things about this T3 copper era that's so hard to get reliable information about is because when the next system came in, the patriarchal systems, they basically said that is vice and we have to blot it out. We have to destroy it because we don't want that interfering with our new systems. And so you don't want people running off to the fertility cult temples anymore, you know, getting drugged and enslaved, and you know, you go to a party and wake up in chains the next day, castrated. Not a good thing. Next thing you know, you're working in the salt mines for the rest of your life. So yeah, this is, if you want to understand what was going on in those earlier systems, read the early laws, like the laws in Deuteronomy, for example, of prohibitions. When I was a kid, when I would read, you know, Deuteronomy and Numbers and Leviticus, and it's like, what a strange law that, you know, they would actually put that you're not supposed to do this. And it's like, who was doing that? Well, apparently somebody was doing that, or they wouldn't have had to make it illegal. So now you're making those systems into vices. And so here you're moving into, like I said, the Iron Era. This is the age of Taurus and Scorpio at the beginning. And this is where Usher makes the Hebrew creation myth, 4004 BC. And immediately you're dealing with, you know, things like the fall from the Garden of Eden. You're dealing with Cain killing Abel. You're dealing with Cain's descendants being in the shadows east of Eden in the land of Nod as the bloodline that doesn't keep up with its years anymore. So Cain's lineage is like Lamech, and it's all about vengeance. So Cain was the first murderer in the Hebrew story, and Lamech was proud of his kills. That is that person who counts their kills. And 7 times 7, vengeance shall be mine, is, you know, what Lamech is said to have told his wife. So just, you know, that he will kill someone for slighting him. And so this is sets the genesis of the Jewish spirit. As was it E. Michael Jones says, you know, the Jewish revolutionary spirit, you know, it is a murderous, vengeful, vendetta type system where they think they should be in charge and everything belongs to them. And anybody who doesn't agree with that or tries to get in their way or stand their ground, the entire swarm targets that person and takes them out. And then, you know, it's like we, you know, we're the victims here. That person was standing up for their own property, etc. You know, we can't have that. And so this idea of the vengeance and the revolutionary spirit that, you know, they're there to tear down anything they don't control. And at the same time that, you know, they're developing this system, the Sumerians were busy creating the Mesopotamian Empire starting around 3500 BC. And then we move into the next age, of the Iron Era, the age of Aries and Libra, you know, Aries the ram and Libra the scales. And so here you're kind of getting away from, you know, the idea of there's only one penalty for breaking any of the laws, and that's the death penalty. You know, that if you basically upset the queen, the evil queen, it's off with your head. If you challenge the king would kill you. And so this idea, well, we're losing some of our best people in these, you know, battle royales. Well, let's start having laws that are more balanced. And the idea of Libra, the scales, and you start seeing eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, life for a life type justice, where, you know, not every slight is a killing offense, unless, of course, it's an outsider. And this is the big thing, I think, that most Europeans and Christians don't understand about these systems like Judaism, that, you know, their laws only apply to them. You are an infidel. You're an outsider. If you, you know, break any of our laws, it is the death penalty. You know, Noahide laws are real clear about this. You break any of the 7 Noahide laws, it's death by beheading. But for us, it's this eye for an eye justice system. And so here, you know, you're moving into a system in 1850, you have the first recorded murder trial in Sumer where three men were sentenced to death for the murder of a temple servant. And so that idea of, you know, you had a murder trial and the verdict was a life for a life. And then in 1700 BC, the Hammurabi Stele, the king of Babylon, you know, here are the laws. And another thing that's interesting is we're moving into this area is the story of Prometheus and his sentence. Some people put Jason and the Argonauts' quest for the Golden Fleece around 1400. Other people put it back around 2000 BC. And this is, of course, Jason and the Argonauts, the first ship to hold an entire crew of men. And he got the best of the best men, including people like Heracles or Hercules, to go on the search for the Golden Fleece. And one of the side adventures of this was when Heracles or Hercules goes and frees Prometheus. And Prometheus was, of course, the one who gave fire to, he was a Titan and gave fire to men. And this became, you know, the foundation of civilization. And as a punishment, in the modern versions, it's Zeus sentenced Prometheus to eternal torment by chaining him to a rock, and then each day his liver would be eaten out by an eagle, only to heal up at night, and then the next day the eagle would be back tearing out his liver. So this idea of torturing somebody for all time for what they did, rather than just killing them, you want to torment them. So this idea of torture, coming into a legal system, and that usually this is done by the shadow hand type systems to make an example for everybody else not to break that rule. You torture somebody to death, and everybody else says, I don't want that to happen to me, so I'm not going to do that. And one of the other parts of the myth of Prometheus is that he stayed there as an example for everyone for years and years and years and years, and no one would help Prometheus because they knew they would suffer the wrath of the gods if they interfered. And so you think how many people, see crimes, but, I'm not going to get involved because I don't want the wrath coming down on me and my household. You're inviting the Furies by getting into the matters of the gods, so to speak. And so it was one of the huge parts of that story was Hercules being brave enough to rescue Prometheus from his eternal torment. And so when we look at these groups like, Murder Incorporated and the Cheka and the NKVD and the modern Israeli Mossad, that they are the world's masters on torturing people to death in the most horrific ways to not only satisfy whatever, sadistic urges they have that they feel are justified, that they're somehow getting, vengeance and justice by torturing these people in this sadistic manner, but also to set an example that, we are the mad dogs, that, no one should mess with us or we will do this to you. And this idea of torture as part of intellectual terrorism, to basically beat people down through fear that, I don't want to, piss off the Israelis because they will torture me to death in some black site. And so it's just interesting how these torture systems have developed into these quasi-legal systems like Judaism. Around 628 is when Thera erupts near Crete and widespread famine and displacement. 1600 is when we're told that Jacob and sons go to Egypt because of the famine. Then 1400, Moses, the lawgiver and the Ten Commandments and the Pentateuch and the Torah and the mitzvah. 613, mitzvah and with the 365 do nots and the 268 do's that make up Jewish law in stone. And these laws only apply to other Jews. Everybody else is goyim, and they don't apply. And that's what Christians just don't understand, that Jews are not playing the same set of game rules. Then we move into the age of Pisces and Virgo. 33 A.D., Jesus is crucified. 70 A.D., the temple at Jerusalem is destroyed. This begins the diaspora at the core of the identity politics of the Jews, and this revenge vendetta that, that war never ended against the Romans and by extension Roman Catholics, by extension, all Christians, by extension, all Europeans, by extension, basically the entire planet. If you're not going to be our slaves, we are at war with you for what you did to us. We are completely justified in our revenge vendetta. In 180, Arianus composes the first Christian Bible. 313, Constantine declares Christianity the religion of the Roman Empire. But yet, you know, you have cells of Jews in every major city in the Roman Empire and later in the Ottoman Empire. You know, these Jewish cells that are all networked, all doing trade, all doing, you know, money lending and, you know, all, you know, all the vices. You know, you always went to the Jews for your vices. From alcohol to prostitution, et cetera, drugs. And so this is, you know, what we talked about last week was you've got a hostile system inside another system. This system, you know, has no intention of ever assimilating. They have nothing but contempt and hatred of the larger system. They think that they're supposed to be in charge. And so this diaspora period did nothing but fuel that Jewish identity of the eternal innocent victim and that they deserve revenge because they were given the planet and weren't able to hold on to it, but they're going to work and take it back, and then everyone's going to pay for all the supposed crimes against the Jews. So this, yeah, this is what was being taught in all the synagogues to all the children from day one, that you are the victims. Every one of the Jewish holidays is about Jewish victimization and revenge and how their enemies suffered. So it's just a very, you know, it's a revenge porn system. Then Constantine declares, 800, the Holy Roman Empire under Charlemagne. 900, the term Satan appears in Old English lexicon meaning adversary. So this idea of there is a power system that is at odds with everything else in the land. And you can't see it. It's invisible, but it's there. And that's the thing about the hidden king. You know, it's a power system that, you know, you can't put your finger on. There's not an office you can go to register a complaint. It's outside of your laws. Then 1066, the Norman invasion of England. 1099, the Priory of Zion is formed. 1118, the Knight Templars are formed as basically the military police arm, enforcement arm of the Priory of Zion. 1126, the Knight Templars return from their excavations in Jerusalem, bringing back the Talmud, the Zohar, the Kabbalah, Tarot, Sacred Magic, Paper, Melon, Mage, all those black magic systems that are associated with this part of Judaism. And this, you know, so-called modern Judaism at launched the Zionist, you know, world Zionist movement of this Jewish supremacy. 1182, Jews expelled from France. 1215, the Magna Carta. How do you deal with Jews? You know, and it's interesting that even in the Magna Carta, they blotted out sections, what is it, 11 and 12 about dealing with Jews. That school children, when they go to see the Magna Carta, don't even see what it, the whole point was about. It was, you know, these people trying to deal with these hostile Jews that were in their land. Then 1290, Jews expelled from England. 1306, Jews expelled from France again. 1307, the Jews are, Knights Templars are arrested. 1458, the Book of the Sacred Magic of Abramel and the Mage begins to appear in Europe in Hebrew. This prompted things like the Spanish Inquisition in 1481. 1492, the Jews are expelled from France. Columbus sails under Knight Templar flag banners to the New World to try to find a place for the Jewish people. And this is the big thing about Christopher Columbus. It's like The Jews are going to continue to be expelled from Europe. We tried to take Jerusalem back during the Crusades. We failed. Now we've got to find another place for the Jewish people. In 1605, on November 5th, Guy Fawkes, interesting story, the gunpowder plot to blow up the English Parliament and King James I. And, of course, the poem goes, "Remember, remember, the 5th of November, the gunpowder treason and plot. I see no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot." And, you know, this is, you know, the Jewish mindset. And they always say, well, it was this Catholic guy, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, was it really? You know, who really benefited from this? Who was behind the gunpowder plot? And who keeps that Guy Fawkes image going? In 1626, Zabbatai Zevi is born. 1656, Jews return to England. 1660, you know, officially, that's one of the big things about 1605, is like how many crypto-Jews, you know, were already back in England trying to, you know, reclaim from where they'd gotten thrown out before. So again, 1626, Zabbatai Zevi's born, starts that messianic movement of, you know, basically doing evil for redemption. 1656, Jews return to England officially. 1666, the Great Fire of London. 1694, the Bank of England is established, which creates all the wealth to move forward this Jewish agenda, and it also to indebt or put everyone else, all the Gentiles, in debt slavery to the Bank of England. And remember, it's forbidden for one Jew to charge interest to another Jew, but, you know, interest usury is for Gentiles. 1717, the Grand Lodge of London's established. 1726, Jacob Frank claims to be the reincarnation of Zabbatai Zevi and continues the, you know, transgression. And it's basically salvation through transgression movement of doing evil things for the sake of evil and to push forward the agenda that, you know, mainly Christian law, Christian morality does not apply to us. And this is where you start to see the ruthlessness of the communist movement, the Marxist movement, the Zionist movement, where the ends justify the means. Don't get hung up on morality. There is no good and evil. It's just power. You know, power for power's sake. 1776, the Illuminati is founded with Weishaupt and Rothschild. 1832, Skull and Bones is founded at Yale. 1843, Benaiah B'rith, the Children of the Covenant, is founded. 1845, Karl Marx does his thesis on Feuerbach. The philosophers have only interpreted the world in different ways. The point is to change it. Tikkun Olam, you know, worldview, we're taking over the world, and you Gentiles can't stop us, you know, by any means necessary. 1848, Marx and Engels do the Communist Manifesto. 1871, Albert Pike publishes Morals and Dogma of the Ancient and Accepted Scottish Rite in the year of the world, 5680. So here, you know, Albert Pike, you know, making a point that he has disavowed Christianity and is saying his Freemasons are on the world calendar, the year of the world, 5680. And this is interesting how the Freemason calendar is almost in sync with the Jewish calendar. So it's this little bitty delta there of when the Freemasons say their calendar starts and when the Jews say their calendar starts. And you know, we'll do a show on that sometime because that's a little interesting piece of history there, Freemason lore. 1875 to 80, the word intransigent begins to appear in the English lexicon, referring to someone who refuses to agree or compromise, that are completely inflexible, that act like they're in a master-slave system, that they are the master and what they say goes. You know, there's no discussion here. We are going to get our way one way or the other, either with the carrot or with the stick, but we will get our way. And this is like when Warburg addressed the U.S. Senate in the 50s and said, we will have world government. The question is, will it come by consent or conquest? But, you know, this type of intransigence is also part of that Jewish mindset that, you know, you are not going to win an argument with the Jew. You know, it's just not going to happen. They are just in this, we're superior, we should be in charge, and you're stupid goyim, you're cattle. You know, you exist only to serve us. 1896, Theodore Herzl writes The Jewish State. 1897, the first World Zionist Congress is held. 1903, the Protocols of Zion are published. 1904, April 8th, 9th, and 10th, Aleister Crowley dictates the Book of the Law in Cairo, Egypt, with its maxim, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. And one of the things, when he's talking about all the religions of the old order, he talks about Christianity, he talks about Islam, he talks about Buddhism, he talks about Hinduism, but he does not say anything about Judaism being erased in the New World Order. So that's very telling. And when the person was writing the V for Vendetta graphic novel, they left in all the Aleister Crowley references that were taken out for the most part of the movie. But throughout the graphic novel, you know, the character V is constantly saying, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. I am on this vendetta. Ends justify the means. I am beyond good and evil. And so you can really see the Aleister Crowley influence on the original V graphic novel. 1913, the ADL is formed as basically a psychological warfare unit and spy agency on the American people, serving Jewish interests. 1917, December 5th, the Cheka secret police are formed in Russia as part of the Bolshevik Revolution. This is the All-Russian Extraordinary Commission, and it was interesting, they were all Jewish. You know, basically a secret police mainly made up of Jews. They had a few token Russians there, but like the Bolshevik leadership, they were all Jewish, and they were this star chamber justice system to carry out counter-revolution measures. And basically, they were a spy agency that would target individuals that they thought were counter-revolutionary, and they would torture them to death. By the late 1918, hundreds of Cheka committees were in place. So basically everywhere there was a synagogue, you had a Cheka outpost, and they were basically running roughshod over all of the Gentiles. And they, like I said, the most horrific things you can imagine that they always project onto the National Socialists for World War II, and they say, oh, the Nazis did all these horrible things to the Jews. No, they can't prove any of that. But nobody disagrees that what the Cheka did to the Russians was some of the most horrific, barbarous, sadistic torture you can ever imagine. And, of course, there are no Hollywood movies about that. In 1922, they were replaced by the NKVD, but the NKVD was about as Jewish as the Cheka. And one of the things that's interesting about one of the main Cheka badges is it has that big V symbol on it of, you know, the Jewish volcano god, the killer god, you know, the wrathful god of Judaism, you know, that V symbol. So I always thought that was interesting on those Cheka badges that, you know, that was, you know, the V symbol with the hammer and sickle. 1973, Leo Strauss dies. He was a Jewish philosopher, professor who came to the United States to preach his Marxist philosophy, and he was one of the ones who really cemented the idea of the ends justify the means and the noble lie. That, you know, a lie is permissible if you're doing good with it. If you're talking about a peace deal, you can lie. You know, if it's to your interest over the goyim, you can lie. And so the idea of the noble lie, carrying out a false flag operation like 9/11 to get your war going, that's the noble lie. And when you look at his students, it reads like a bar mitzvah list of all the neocons and neolibs that would come into power in the 1980s and 1990s. People like Scooter Libby, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, all of those guys in the Project for the New American Century studied under Leo Strauss. He was, you know, the intellectual of the New World Order. And so much of those Project for the New American Century documents come right out of Leo Strauss's philosophy. 1982, V for Vendetta, graphic novel published by Alan Moore and illustrated by David Lloyd, depicting a dystopian Christian police state in the United Kingdom that's homophobic and Islamophobic and is taken down through terrorism by the V character who has the vendetta, that he feels totally justified in carrying out these acts of terror against what he calls the corrupt police state. This was picked up by DC Comics, and of course DC Comics is completely Jewish, and it's amazing how many of these Antifa we have running around in the United States and in Europe, you know, were weaned on that graphic novel and the movie. V for Vendetta. It was hugely successful, and it just totally fed into that anarchist mindset of Antifa. Then in 1997, Project for the New American Century is founded, or PNAC. This was, you know, what were formerly Trotskyite communists suddenly shaved their hair and put on a suit, and now they're neoconservatives and looking after Jewish interests and infiltrating the United States government at the highest levels. In September 11, 2001, you have the new Pearl Harbor of 9/11, and this launched the Odin-Yenin plan for Greater Israel and got us into these decades of wars for Greater Israel. 2006, V for Vendetta is released by Warner Brothers. And it was, the screenplay was by the trans sisters, the Wachowski sisters that were guys and then had sex change operations or whatever. And, you know, this was a highly successful movie. And again, you know, very, very popular in Antifa circles. And it's basically promoting terrorism as a means to an end, justifiable terrorism. Tear down all the symbols and assassinate the leaders because they can't be re-educated. And it's just like out of Manus Friedman, the only way to fight a moral war is the Jewish way. Destroy their temples, kill men, women, children, and cattle. You know, just obliterate it and bring in your new world order. And then August 11th, 12th, the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. This was, you know, definitely a trap. And what we saw after that was just the systematic effort by American Jews to dox and destroy everyone who showed up for that rally for the Unite the Right. We still have, you know, so many people in jail, so many people have had their lives completely destroyed by this targeting of these individuals that attended that event. And then in January 2020, Project Veritas released their next round of exposés on the Bernie Sanders campaigns, this time in South Carolina, where you had paid staffers talking about how all of the people who can't adopt to the new diversity, globo homo, new world order have to be sent to gulags in America and re-education camps. And those of us who can't be re-educated just need to be killed to, quote, denazify America. So, with that said, you are listening, you have been listening to Blackburn Nine's Breakfast Club. I'm your host, Frederick C. Blackburn. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us at the Trading Post this evening. And until next time, I will see you all at the rendezvous.